So the topic for the talk tonight is the five precepts. And this evening I'm going to do an overview of why I feel the precepts are really important. And it's not just me who thinks it's important. And then we'll talk about the first precept as well. I've been part of the Sangha since the fall of 2009, right after Rania founded it. And I've started teaching right away. And this is the third time that I've talked about the precepts. I'm kind of like the precepts guy here, you know? And, you know, it's kind of ironic because I never thought that that would be something I would really love talking about, but I really do. And I think it's because I've had teachers who've helped me understand really why ethics are so important to my practice. And I've also seen the impact in community when the precepts have not been practiced. I've seen the pain and the damage that's been done when ethics have not been practiced. So I'm going to tell you basically what the five precepts are in case you're not familiar with them. They're stated in different ways, but the basic outline is, the first one is, I undertake the precept to refrain from destroying living creatures. The second is, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Stealing. Three, I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. Four, I undertake the precept to refrain from incorrect speech. And five, I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs which lead to carelessness. Now, I'll say right at the outset, there are a lot of interpretations about what it means to follow these precepts within the community. And I'll also say that depending on what lineage you're part of, whether you're in Zen or the Theravadan tradition, insight practice, or in Tibetan and so on, there's a different level of importance placed on them. I spent a year living in a Tibetan retreat center in the high desert of New Mexico. We never talked about them once. Never came up. Never was discussed, never taught by the teacher. Once. And I'm not saying that to criticize them, but I can tell you I saw consequences there. I saw consequences. And I experienced consequences. Severe consequences as a result. So there's also a positive expression of these that I want to mention. And what we essentially are doing, going through these five precepts, is number one, we're saying we're going to practice compassionate action. That's the one on not destroying living creatures. The second one about not stealing, we practice contentment and generosity. The third one about sexual misconduct, we practice responsibility for all our relationships. Fourth is incorrect speech. We practice refraining from harmful speech. And the Buddha gives very clear instructions about what that means. And the fifth, in terms of intoxication, we practice caring for our bodies and our minds. So within wisdom traditions, within spirituality, some type of ethics seems to keep showing up. I was raised Catholic, and so, you know, the Ten Commandments were right there. But it was always like somebody was pointing a finger at me going, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And I had this notion that if I violated any of those, I was going to get struck by lightning, God was going to come down and smite my ass somehow. It was like it was sort of imposed on me in that way. And I think that's true you know, for a lot of people, they feel that way about this. The thing to understand about these precepts that's very important is it's a practice. It's a practice. It's not something being imposed by some outside force. The Buddha developed them because he understood how important they were to live in community and to do practice. So the Buddhist path basically consists of three areas of practice, which all support each other. They're all linked and connected to each other, as if they were like three legs of a stool, in a sense. You know, you have a two-legged stool, don't work too well. Three legs, we're going to be okay, right? So one of those is ethics, or as it's referred to in Sanskrit, sila, S-I-L-A. So we have the ethics and the sila, or sila. The second one is concentration practice, which is referred to as samadhi. And the third practice is wisdom, or prajna, or panya. So we have ethics, we have concentration, and we have wisdom. And it's called the threefold training. And this is really outlined in the Eightfold Path. Now, if you remember the Four Noble Truths, basically what Buddha said in his first teaching and what he kept re-emphasizing over and over again in the decades that he taught, he said, I teach the cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering. And the Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path, where he lays out what to do. He didn't leave us hanging. He didn't say, well, there's suffering, and then there's a way out of suffering, and you guys figure it out. He said, here's the Eightfold Path. You do this practice, and you can find freedom and relief from suffering, and you can experience awakening, just as I have. So the Eightfold Path, the first two practices, or the first two in the Eightfold Path, are right view and right intention, which are the wisdom factors. And if you want to go through and really get in depth in the Eightfold Path, you can search back the back through our website. I did a talk on it about 3 months ago. Or you can Google it or go on YouTube and listen to somebody a lot smarter than me explain it. But there's a lot of information about it. But the first two are right view and right intention. These are the wisdom factors. The third, fourth, and fifth are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Let's see, right speech. Let me see, I think we heard that one in the precepts, right? Right action and right livelihood. Well, that covers the other four. And then the last three parts of the Eightfold Path are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. These are part of the concentration practice. So the threefold training is laid out in the Eightfold Path. It's right there. And they all support each other. So we're going to talk about how they relate to each other. And this is one of these situations where I wish I had a whiteboard or a flip chart or something, because I could do these cool little drawings. But Thich Nhat Hanh, who I'm sure at least most of you are familiar with, the great Zen teacher, he talks a lot about the precepts. They're very, very important. I did a 21-day retreat at Plum Village back in 2000. And at the end of the retreat, we were given the opportunity to take the five precepts. He calls them the five wonderful precepts. And he talks about how they relate to each other. And this is a great book if you want to get his take on it. It's called For a Future to Be Possible, Commentaries on the Five Wonderful Precepts. And I'll read something that he said in there. In Buddhism, precepts, concentration, and insight always go together. It is impossible to speak of one without the other. Practicing the precepts brings about concentration, and concentration is needed for insight. Concentration allows us to look deeply And insight is the fruit of looking deeply. Practicing the precepts helps us to be more calm and concentrated and bring more insight and enlightenment, which then makes the practice of the precepts more solid. The three are intertwined, each helps the other two. All three bring us closer to final liberation. And the way I saw him explain this is he drew a circle with three arrows all going the same direction. So there's the precepts, ethics, or sila, and then there's the concentration, or samadhi, and then you have wisdom, or prajna, all supporting each other. And one of my teachers is Lee Brazington, and the way he explained it, he said, imagine how the precepts are practiced in the Eightfold Path, and it's like an eight-lane highway. And you're driving, imagine you're in LA, right? And you got these eight-lane highways, and you know how they drive out there, right? They just change lanes like that. Imagine that you're going down this highway, moving back and forth from one to another. They all go like that. Or you can think of the three-legged stool. So they all fit together. You know, going back to my original point that they're not covered very often, I think it's because talking about precepts and ethics isn't sexy. You know, it's like, oh, let's talk about emptiness, man. I want to hear about emptiness. Dependent origination, that's deep, man. Let's talk about that. You know, this stuff about, oh, I can't. No intoxicants, and no lies, and no killing. I mean, stay away from that. But yet, it's right there, woven right into the Eightfold Path. Lee Brazington talks about the importance of how they fit together. He talks about the fact that to have wisdom, to really gain insights, we need a certain level of concentration, right? If our mind is all over the place, we do not have the capacity to develop any understanding and insights into how our mind works. We can't really study the Dharma and understand these teachings. We need some concentration and focus. And he said, how are we going to get concentration and focus without practicing ethics? He said, imagine, if you're out there robbing banks, and you're wondering when the cops are going to catch you. You know, if you're out there wreaking havoc, it's hard to have a calm, still mind and develop concentration. And when he said that, it was so clear. So the precepts have become an integral part of the teachings. Jack Kornfield's primary teacher, Ajahn Chah, the great Thai master, says, with virtue as the basis of everything we do, our mind becomes kind, clear, and quiet. Meditation can grow easily in this soil. So the monks, the monastic community, they take vows to practice precepts. Of course, they have so many more than just the five precepts. In the Theravadin tradition, they have 227. It's called the Vinaya. Am I pronouncing that right, Vinaya? So these are the Buddhists in Burma, Cambodia, you know, Laos, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and so on. As I mentioned before, at Plum Village, within the Zen tradition, we took the five precepts. I lived for 6 months at Green Gulch, which is part of the San Francisco Zen Center. And they really stressed the precepts there. That's a community that's been around since the early 60s, and they've learned the importance of the precepts. And my primary teacher out there was Reb Anderson, and he wrote a book called Being Upright, subtitled Zen Meditation and the Bodhisattva Precepts. Well, they know a little bit about why it's important to practice the precepts, because if you know about the history of the San Francisco Zen Center, they were virtually almost destroyed back in the 70s because of a teacher who was not practicing the precepts, and students were not practicing it. So it's very, very strongly emphasized there. When we go out to Southern Dharma Retreat Center, every retreat I've ever done out there, we take the precepts at the very beginning. It creates a safe, firm foundation to do a retreat. We have a leadership team here that we meet periodically. Every time we met, we always started by taking the precepts. Always. So in the Dhammapada, which is a foundational teaching of Buddhism, they say this: not to do any evil, to cultivate good, to purify one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. You want to put it on a bumper sticker? And we used to have this: do no harm. All right? And of course, there's the karmic implications of this, which we could spend a lot of time on. But obviously, we could spend a lot of time on that. But I want to move on to the first precept, which is the reverence for life. Or we take the precept not to harm any living beings. And this is one that gets really, really interesting. We'll get into that. But here's something from the suttas. It says, I undertake the training rule to abstain from taking life. And it denotes any living or specifically sentient being, meaning that which breathes and has consciousness. So a sentient being does not include plants, because they don't have a brain and nervous system. I know there's this big debate about whether carrots cry when we cut them and pick them or not. We're not going to get into that tonight, but basically it doesn't include harvesting your carrots. But here's what the Theravadan Buddhists say is a violation of the first precept involving reverence for life and not harming. The first criteria is, or first factor is, that there is a sentient being. Second, that there's the perception and understanding that the being is a living being. The third, that there's a volitional thought of killing or harming. The fourth, that the killing is actually carried out. And fifth, that the being actually dies. So they're very specific and particular about what that means. Rule of thumb, if you want to know something about the Dharma, go check out the Theravadan teachers. They're the ones, especially the monks. I mean, they're really rooted in this. And they say if all these five conditions are fulfilled, the first precept is violated. In the Brahmanet Sutra, it's stated this way: a disciple of the Buddha shall not himself kill, encourage others to kill, kill by expedient means, praise killing, rejoice at witnessing killing, or kill through incantation or deviant mantras. He must not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of killing, and shall not intentionally kill any living creature. So be careful with those deviant mantras. So the first really important point to note about this is taking life as divine, defined by volition. In other words, the power of one's free will. It's the mental factor responsible for action. So what volition does is it arouses this whole mental formation for accomplishing a particular aim, which is ending the life of a being. It's actually generating this thought process and this intention to do that. That's the most serious factor. And killing does not necessarily occur directly through the body. The volition to take life can also express through the door of speech. This means that the command to take life, given to others by way of words, writing, or gesture is also considered an act of killing. So just like in the court system, you know, I mean, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, Adolf Hitler, is there any evidence they actually pulled the trigger? But just as the court system would dictate, they're responsible for the taking of life. There's that volition, there's that intention. So there really, there's a professor of theology and nun in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition named Karma Lekshi Somo. She explains, there are no moral absolutes in Buddhism, and it's recognized that ethical decision-making involves a complex nexus of causes and conditions. When making moral choices, individuals are advised to examine their motivation, whether aversion, attachment, ignorance, wisdom, or compassion, and to weigh the consequences of their actions in light of the Buddha's teachings. Acts of killing usually originate from the three unwholesome roots. The Buddha taught the three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. It usually comes from those. And they all originate in our minds. Check out our motivation. So, you know, we ask ourselves, well, what does this mean? Does this mean that I should be a vegetarian? Right? Well, the Buddha wasn't a vegetarian. The Buddha wasn't a vegetarian. The Dalai Lama is not a vegetarian. Thich Nhat Hanh's a vegetarian. Reb Anderson is a vegetarian. But a lot of teachers aren't vegetarians. I'm not a vegetarian. I have been. So what does that mean? What is my volition? What is my intention? It begins in the mind. So there seems like there's some wiggle room in there. It's a practice. That's what it comes down to. So, from my point of view, someone who is, and this is my opinion, okay? Someone who abstains from eating meat and takes a high moral ground is not any better than someone who consciously consumes meat but dedicates the merit and benefit of eating it to all beings. That's my spin on it. Like I said, this is a controversial, difficult question. What's the intention? What's the motivation? The first distinction given in killing is what kind of moral qualities are involved. Thich Nhat Hanh says, the first precept is born from the awareness that lives everywhere are being destroyed. We see the suffering caused by the destruction of life, and we vow to cultivate compassion and use it as a source of energy for the protection of people, animals, plants, and minerals. We must protect the ecosystem to protect ourselves. When we get in our car and drive here, are we killing things? Ants? Bugs that hit our windshield? When we boil water, are we killing microorganisms? There are a lot of nuances to this. A lot of questions arise. When I lived at this Tibetan retreat center, they ate meat voraciously. I was the cook for quite a while, and they would complain if I served too many vegetarian dishes and not enough meat. We need more meat. I used to hear this all the time. And yet, it was interesting because I remember one time a woman wanted to go somewhere in her car, and she went out and she flipped open the hood of her car because she hadn't driven the car in a while, and she wanted to check her oil. She opened up the hood and there were ants crawling all over her engine. Well, she didn't want to drive the car because she was afraid of killing an ant. But she had just eaten a hamburger. So I'm like trying to understand this. We had two horses out there. And they were really old. That was another one of my jobs, was to feed the horses. Well, the horses were all crippled up. And I remember one winter, I thought they were just suffering so much, but they didn't want to put the horses down. You know what I mean, right? Put them down. Because they felt that to do that would interfere with that animal purifying karma. That if the animals suffered before they died, they would purify karma and have a more propitious or better rebirth. And I was just always trying to sort this thing out. Like, and the ranchers, this was a ranch out in the high desert, the ranchers around used to see this and they were very critical of us because I grew up on a farm. When an animal's suffering, you put it out of its misery. I remember my dad one time told me there was a deer tangled up in a barbed wire fence. He handed me the .22 and he said, go put it out of its misery. Is this practicing the precept? Do no harm. These are difficult questions. That's why I say it's a practice. If we do eat meat, how do we approach it? If we do believe that carrots cry when we cut them, see, all these questions come up. It keeps coming back to motivation and awareness, mindfulness. There's more I could go into on this. I got pages of notes. Let me just touch on a couple things, and that is about going back to the original point that the positive expression of the precepts is to practice compassionate action. So I left you with some questions and perhaps some difficult thoughts, but I want to transition into some practices that you can do. And I have too many notes here. So you can practice relief of suffering practice. So you can empathize with another person, understanding their humanity and suffering, and want that person to be free from suffering. This is a compassion practice, reverence for life. You imagine the suffering of another human being that you've met, and you imagine that you're the one going through that suffering. Reflect on how much you would like that suffering to end. Reflect on how happy you would be if another human being desired your suffering to end and acted on it and opened your heart to that other human being wanting their suffering to end. This is a compassion practice that you can do. There's also Tonglen practice, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. It comes out of the Tibetan tradition, giving and receiving. This is a practice where we imagine the suffering of another human being, and we actually set the intention to take on that suffering as our own. So what we do is we see or feel that suffering, and we actually breathe in with the notion of completely feeling it, accepting it, and owning it. And in the practice, the way I was taught, you actually imagine that you're breathing in black smoke as the suffering of that other person. And then breathing out, you radiate compassion, loving kindness, freshness, anything that encourages relaxation and openness in the form of a white light. So you breathe in the black smoke and send out, I guess it would be white smoke, not white light. So this is a practice that you can explore if this is of interest to you. The other question that comes up, and I'll end on this note about this question of practicing the first precept, doing no harm. What about serving in the military? Right now, there are more than 3,000 Buddhists serving in the United States Armed Forces. People identify as Buddhists, including some Buddhist chaplains. Buddhism does not demand absolute pacifism. So there aren't any hard and fast rules. What do we do when it comes to euthanizing an animal that suffers? What about euthanasia among people? What about dealing with pests? What do you do when you have cockroaches in your house? What if you're in Africa and you are at threat of malaria and mosquito lands on you? Do you swat it? See? So it all comes back to the mind. According to the Buddha, the mind is the base of all action, everything. The violation of the precept is going to arise in the mind.